This is a CBC podcast.
Get in on the debate. Big city or small suburb, the 180 gets you talking about what's going on in Canada. Host Jim Brown brings you a fresh take on the stories that matter. Join the conversation. Go to cbc.ca/the180.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas.
The cemetery was huge. I went to some funerals. They weren't like modern funerals. There was no food, no wake. Those who felt some mercy for the dead person dug a grave just deep enough to cover a body. I see all those who died as if they were still alive, in front of me now. Those funerals were more like the funerals of horses than of human beings.
In 1932, Joseph Stalin faced two monumental problems, a food shortage in Russia and political insurgency in Ukraine. So he decided to kill two birds with one stone. He closed the borders with Ukraine and seized the grain harvest. Then he did it again the next year. Around 8 million people died of starvation. But Russia got its food and the insurgency was crushed.
I was born in 1945 when our village was surrounded with Soviet military units. They took my mother, who was pregnant with me at the time, and they beat her with steel rods until she started to give birth. This is how I was born. After this, when I see that Russia feels in some way superior to us, and I see their attitude to Ukraine, then I understand that the Russians only understand strength. This is how we should act. This museum is, of course, just a museum, but it's all I can do for the truth.
4 years ago, Ideas broadcast a two-part series called The Great Hunger to trace how great disasters ripple down through history. The Irish potato famine of the 1840s and the Holodomor, or hunger extermination, as it's known in Ukraine. Today on Monday, we're rebroadcasting that series with new material. Today's program is about Ukraine. We've updated the story of how the Holodomor shapes today's Ukraine with some up-to-the-minute interviews. The Great Hunger is produced and presented by Philip Coulter.
My name is Ostap Krivdik. I'm a political expert and freelance journalist, and at this moment I am performing duties of the International Secretary of Maidan Self-Defense.
I want to ask you a very personal question about Maidan. Many people died, and I think it's easy to forget how many have died at Maidan in the last few months. I suppose my question is, did you know any of the people who died?
My good friend lost his best friend. Some of my friends were wounded. I don't think that I had any personal damage, but psychological one, when I saw wounded people. When I saw dead bodies, I will never forget it. As well as millions of Ukrainians. Yes, this was really close. Yes, this was just the guy who was sitting next to me. So maybe I didn't know him too well, but he's not with us anymore. And the whole Ukrainian society actually feels like this. I think this big tragedy is a uniting moment for us, and it's a guarantee for Ukrainian reforms, because this sacrifice will definitely be here, and this heavenly unit of self-defense will always be with us. We feel those people, they motivate us to act in a certain way.
In a small village in northern Ukraine, an elderly woman with a flowered headscarf and a proper blue jacket sits on her bed beside the brick stove. She is one of the few left alive who remember the Holodomor, the years of hunger when everyone around was hungry and dying.
Мене звуть Катерина Івановна Шльончик. Що мені починати? Я ще тоді була мала.
My name is Катерина Івановна Шльончик, she says. This is where I should start.
18 душ сім'я була одна.
I was 7 years old and our family was very big. There were 18 of us. My father, my uncle and my grandfather's three sons. A really big family. We weren't rich, but we were okay. We had our own land and we worked it ourselves. We had four horses, two plows, a flock of 50 sheep, several cows. We were quite well off. Then collectivization began. My grandfather didn't want to join the kolkhoz and give them everything, so he refused, and so they called him a kulak, a class enemy, and took everything. Dekulakization, it was called. She says, "This isn't my original home. I got this land later. I was brought up by strangers because of the Holodomor and collectivization. When they declared us kulaks, they took all the pigs and horses, everything we had. Before that happened, my grandfather had decided to divide the family property in three so that each son could decide whether or not to join the collective. But then they came and drove us off and took everything anyway." The early years of the Soviet Union were marked by debates over the practical exercise of Marxism. Were peasant farmers capitalists? If not all of them, then which? These questions dovetailed with economic questions. How do we maximize grain production? Ukraine was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, and to an economist sitting in Moscow, the small farms of Ukraine must have seemed terribly inefficient. Quotas had to be set and met. The political and the economic solutions were the same. The farms would be collectivized. As for the question of who was a peasant, a genuine worker, and who was a capitalist farmer, a kulak, well, there would be a formula for figuring that out, and a way for dealing with kulaks. This is Sergei Horobets. He's a local historian and a history instructor at Chernihiv University. Where are we? What's the name of this community? We're in the village of Petrushin, he tells us, about 20 kilometers north of the city of Chernihiv, about 50 kilometers from the Russian border. Talk a little bit about the changes that took place, that would have taken place in this region, in this community, after the arrival of the Soviets, after 1917. The changes were gradual at first, says Sergei. These were all private farms in the 1920s. The first collective wasn't started until 1929. The private farmers were traditionally very strong here. No one wanted to join the collective. Most of the Ukrainian peasants opposed collectivization and quotas. They also resented not being paid market prices for their grain. There was a worldwide recession, too, and food shortages in other parts of the Soviet Union, all of which interfered with Moscow's economic plans. Last but not least, demands for greater Ukrainian autonomy had become troublesome to Moscow. Ukrainian grain was crucial to the Soviet economy. After they were forced off their land, says Katerina, they tried to survive, but almost all the family died. First her grandparents, then the smallest children, the one-year-old, the two- and three- and five-year-old, they all died, one by one, over 3 days. They had nothing to eat, so they swelled up and died. I want to ask you a question about Maidan. You were there at the beginning of all of this and through the last few months, and I guess you're there again now. Give me a picture of what it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
And then give me another picture of what is there now. What is the snapshot of Maidan today as opposed to a couple of weeks ago?
So, the protest started with Mr. Yanukovych using the hand of Prime Minister Mr. Azarov to stop the process of Ukrainian integration into European Union. Then the very first group to protest were pro-European youth, pro-European middle class and students. Then when regime attacked, when at night of November the 30th, Maidan was smashed by the riot police, a different kind of people, those who were against Yanukovych and his criminal elite joined it. And later, when the shooting started, it was more about the radical group, ethno-nationalists who joined in and who performed actively. And at any of those stages, society was adequate, but the government was setting up the higher and higher level of violence, so society had to reply, and there were moments when the radical answer was the only answer. At this moment, we have an occupation of part of Ukraine's sovereign territory. We are facing the full-scale war. Actually, occupation is war already, isn't it? And therefore, people who are standing at Maidan are standing on the same barricades, but the barricade now is a border of Ukraine. So Maidan continues.
Sergei takes me to the old wooden church, spared by the Soviets because it made a useful lookout point and a storage shed for the army. Collectivization and de-kulakization, as it was called, had started in 1929. In 1930 and again in 1931, the quotas were increased, but still there was not enough grain to satisfy Moscow. In 1932, Stalin closed the borders, increased the quotas to astronomical levels, and sent in the party loyalists to sort things out, to enforce the quotas and collectivization, and also deal with the remaining kulaks. We take a detour, walking in the hot summer sun down the dusty country road and through a high wooden fence to meet another survivor of the Holodomor, sitting in the sunshine outside her house. How long have you lived here, Maria?
Довго. Це вже ж бачите, мені вже 88 років. Я вже тут дуже-дуже давно живу. Дуже давно живу.
I have lived in this village for a long time, says Maria Lobas. I'm 88 years old, and I have a daughter in Chernihiv and a son in Russia.
Ну, у нас вже ж хоч картопля добула.
During the Holodomor, we lived without anything. In our house, we had some potatoes, and we managed to survive. But many other people only had white wheat blossoms to eat and to try and make bread from. I remember that whole families were dying out. Our family survived because we had some potatoes. This is my husband's land. This is his yard, she says. I lived further down near the village. I moved here when I married. I remember also people were eating rotten potatoes. They sliced them and made pancakes with these rotten potatoes after they'd soaked them in water for a while to get rid of the smell. People also went to where the dead cattle were buried, and they dug out the bodies of dead horses, cows, bulls, and ate them. In your family, who died? Our whole family survived, Maria says, because we had some potatoes. But I remember that our neighbors died, the whole family. We tried to give them potatoes, but we weren't able to give them enough, so they died. We felt sorry for them, of course, but we felt more sorry for ourselves. There was a brigade, 5 men and 5 women, who went searching through people's yards. They had long metal poles, twice as long as my walking stick, and they were stabbing the floor and the grounds nearby, searching for hidden stores. They took everything away, she says, even clothes that we could exchange for food. Of course, people were hiding their stores, and those who hid them best survived. Our food was hidden under the stove. We hid some of our clothes and fabric from making clothes, too, which they didn't find. But they found all the other clothing we had, and they took everything.
When somebody died, where would they be buried?
We buried our dead in the cemetery. Usually we just wrapped them in old clothes. We would put them on the cart and take them to the cemetery. Those who were stronger would try to dig some kind of grave. It was a time in our village when there were no strong men at all, and the women had to dig the graves on their own. The cemetery must have been a very busy place. The cemetery was huge. I went to some funerals. They weren't like modern funerals. There was no food, no wake. Those who felt some mercy for the dead person dug a grave just deep enough to cover a body, and those graves had no crosses, no sign that someone was buried there. I see all those who died as if they were still alive, in front of me now. Those funerals were more like the funerals of horses than of human beings.
My name is Roman Hurbik, and I'm a doctoral student at Södertörn University in Stockholm. Originally, I'm from Ukraine, and I'm Ukrainian.
Roman, this is not the first time that Ukraine has tried to come out from the shadow of Russia. There's a long history of Ukrainian resistance to Russia. 1917, 1954, 1972, 1988, then up through 1991, 2004, the Orange Revolution. This has happened many times before. The wheel keeps turning and turning. History is repeating itself. I suppose my question is, how do you see it as being different this time?
Since the early 1920s, it can be the first time that it can actually come to a war between Ukraine and Russia. And especially after the decades of the Soviet propaganda that was profiling basically Ukrainians and Russians as branches of the same nation, sort of, as brotherly nations. It is something that is really deeply shocking for many people in Ukraine, especially those who hold Russia and Russian culture, Russian identity dear. It is also important that I think perhaps for the first time we can see something really significant going on in, let's say, southeastern Ukraine, in cities like Dnipropetrovsk, Odessa, Kharkiv, or even Donetsk, where you can see people rallying not just against Ukraine, not just against the government, you know, but rallying for Ukraine. And it's something new, something we haven't really seen in 2004, for instance, in the times of the Orange Revolution. So I think that makes a real difference, and it will make, of course, it very difficult for Russia to impose its agenda in southern and eastern Ukraine.
A few things I want to follow up on here. Mm-hmm. One of them is kind of a historical conundrum. Why is Ukraine so important to Russia? Why is Russia casting such a long shadow over Ukraine and its future?
I think Russians, the problem that they have with Ukraine is that they still can't come to terms with its independence, and they don't perceive of Ukraine as an independent nation. They still see Ukrainians as part of this, you know, larger, like, supranation, Russian supranation.
I don't think history is repeating. Shall we see the example of Finland? Finland had the first challenge of its independence when the Russian Empire collapsed. Then Finland faced second big challenge, being chaired by General Mannerheim. And Finland passed this exam. Ukraine didn't, for many times, for many reasons. Since we didn't, we still have to pass this exam. So this is the single history of my country and my nation. And we are overcoming the same challenge as before. Whether our nation is capable of sustaining its statehood, whether this nation is capable of sustaining its culture, its language, whether this nation is capable to sustain peace and mutual understanding amongst different ethnic and social groups at the sovereign territory. I do think that this revolution and this fight leaves us a good heritage. And if we speak about the lesson which we are, about the exam which we are to pass right now, the key issue is efficiency. Whether our government is efficient or not, whether our people are efficient or not, whether we are united or divided, we are asking those questions to ourselves every time, and we are not going to give it up easily.
Volodymyr Sirosenko is the principal of the village high school. It usually went like this. A man from Chernihiv would show up with a gun and call a meeting, where he declared that the land of so-and-so is now state property, and everything he has too, horses and so on. Anyone who disagreed was penalized with more taxes and left to starve. Anyone who wanted to survive was finally forced to give up their land. In some communities in Ukraine, when the man showed up with a gun in his pocket, the local farmers killed him. Yes, things like that happened in our village. There was at least one incident when a man was shot with a homemade gun, shot through the window of the municipal office, and he died before they could get him to Chernihiv. As recently as 1948, something similar happened. The head of the collective farm was shot by a man whose mother had been beaten for a potato that she should have given to the collective, and he shot him through the same window, too. Before the Holodomor, Volodymyr's family had owned some land and a forest around here. Shortly before his death, Volodymyr says, his grandfather went into the forest, took off his jacket and lay down on it. He said he felt better after lying on his own land. When I look back, says Volodymyr, I feel that the lives of my parents and grandparents were wasted. My grandmother was born in 1902, and she graduated from our local school. She had the right to go to college and get a higher education. I know she wanted to be a doctor, but because of the Holodomor and the war and all that, she wasn't able to fulfill that dream, so she spent her life working on the collective. In a way, her life was wasted. Maybe my father's family succeeded a bit more. One was an accountant and another a school principal. Another aunt was a teacher in Western Ukraine. The revolution and the Holodomor changed the lives of my family. And of course, we lost our land, too. After the fall of the Soviet Union, people did get their land back, after a fashion. Volodymyr got a few hectares from the old collective farm, where he has an apple orchard now. But he points to a greater loss, the loss of human possibilities.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1. We're also on Sirius XM, and you can, of course, stream and download us from cbc.ca/ideas. In the early 1930s, Ukraine had long been struggling to find its own place as an independent republic. But in 1932 and 33, Stalin sealed the borders and stole the harvest. As many as 8 million people died of starvation. That disaster continues to shape Ukraine to this day and plays a role in the current upheaval there. Part one of The Great Hunger is presented by Philip Coulter.
At the Taras Shevchenko National University in Kiev, Valentina Borisenko is compiling an oral history of the Holodomor. All these things happened about 75 years ago. There are a few survivors, and little was written down during the Soviet era to bear witness in the present and for the future about what had happened, let alone to begin the process of thinking about what it all meant. But collecting the testimonies comes first, and there is little time. Those who survive are so old now. Teams of students from her classes spread out across the country, recording what they can.
Ну, зображені ті селяни, які жили ще до Голодомору, скажімо, або ті, які пережили Голодомор, так? От вони.
Valentina Borisenko opens a folder on her desk and some pictures slide out.
Підписали студенти. Є зовсім такі старенькі.
These are photographs of people who survived, she says. They were all born in the 1920s. They were children at the time of the Holodomor. It's interesting that they remember so much about it. They have great memories. They say that they remember the Holodomor as if it were yesterday. The way the government agents came and threw babies out of cradles looking for anything that was hidden, that sort of thing. What is the importance of these oral histories? Why are they important?
Найголовніша важливість усної історії – це те, що в ній є правда. Ця історія правдива.
I think oral history has a truth that documents lack, says Valentina. It's people's truth. No one could invent these stories, say, this is what happened to my family. If someone tells me she lost all her family, then as far as I'm concerned, it's true. Oral history allows us to see the consequences of the Holodomor, how it was organized, and so on. We know, for example, that the government took not just grain and food, but they also took ration coupons and jewelry, personal things, gold, all that. Through oral history, we can see the dreadful plan.
How
do you think, so far, the story of the Holodomor as it comes out, how is that story changing the Ukrainian people?
Змінив. Було б все інакше, якби не було Голодомору. Всі наші негаразди, всі наші біди, які є зараз, от моральні.
A lot, I believe. All our political and moral problems in Ukraine today are a result of the Holodomor. Without the Holodomor, we would be a different people. The whole of our traditional culture and morals were destroyed. Before the Holodomor, it would have been impossible for a human being to be buried without a funeral or left to rot on the ground. All the problems of moral solidarity, of traditional community, of traditional culture, all of these were badly damaged by the Holodomor. They changed the face of the Ukrainian nation. The main outcomes of the Holodomor in terms of community psychology were indifference and hypocrisy, says Valentina. It was important to survive, and we can't judge the people who lived through it for that. We can't judge their behavior as wrong. On the other hand, there were many cases where people did help each other. Those who survived lived because someone helped them. There were, of course, many counterexamples, and indifference and hypocrisy have become more common in Ukrainian society. I myself am afraid of everything now, and this is because of the Holodomor.
І тільки тому вижили. І це є в цих документах.
When you say afraid of everything, what do you mean by that?
Це важко пояснити, але я боюсь.
I have a kind of social fear, she says.
Тобто страх у мені живе.
A fear of government, of others' judgments of me, and of my own judgments. I've talked to many people and they're just like me. I think this is a direct outcome of the Holodomor. Your book, which collects many of these narratives, is called The Candle of Memory. That's a deeply spiritual concept. Can you talk about that?
Я етнограф, і я вірю в те, що померлі люди опікуються живими.
As an anthropologist, I believe that the dead still take care of those who live.
Коли вони помирали, їм не засвітили свічку, вогонь, який єднає.
And those who died during the Holodomor, they didn't have a candle lit for their souls. So what we have to do is light a candle and keep it in our hearts so that their souls may rest. We should keep them in our memory.
І помагали живим. Це важко, мабуть, перекласти, але
if we light such a candle, They will take care of Ukraine.
Тим більше, що вони померли як невинні люди. Вони нічого поганого не зробили.
Humanity should never forget this Holodomor, says Valentina. Those innocent victims will take care of all of us, all of humanity.
Я думаю, вони поможуть нам.
I went to primary school in 1992, and I still remember books with the portrait of Lenin, you know, on the first page. But I was never taught that, really, you know, and I remember then those portraits being torn away or just crossed with a pen, crossed out with a pencil by teachers. So the history that I was taught was, of course, the history of Ukraine. That was not something that, for instance, my parents studied, because they didn't study the history of Ukraine in schools. They could only study the history of the Soviet Union, which was basically Russian history. There was, you know, apart from the official school history, school book history, there was also a sort of oral history and, you know, this kind of popular memory that persisted in my family. So what my mom heard from her parents was basically, you know, that this is the Soviet government is not our government, you know, and we still we accept it because, I mean, it's pointless to wage active struggle against it. But in other families, I can see very different examples. So I have friends who no longer talk to their parents and who, unlike myself, were coming to Maidan without their parents or grandparents. They realize that they no longer share the same ideas with their parents. And that is very typical of many young people from Donetsk, from Kharkiv, from eastern Ukraine, from southern Ukraine, who moved to Kyiv at some point, you know, and live in Kyiv now and are active participants of Maidan and speak Russian and will never let Maidan go too radical in terms of nationalism or whatever, but they don't find this sort of common language, common understanding with their parents.
Since, as you know, the far-right people, the ethno-nationalists were present, as well as the common Russian-speaking people, as the leftists, as the anarchists, as the conservatives, as the bourgeois people, as the liberal democrats, as the socialists, so everybody was there. It was actually nation who was fighting against the corrupt government. I think that the moment that they were standing together, they were dying together, they were pouring their blood together, is a uniting moment. This is the moment of finding a common motherland. There will be a big discussion about it. What kind of democracy shall we have? What kind of lustration shall we have? What will be the best way for Ukraine to get organized? But I definitely do think that those people will always keep in their mind that they were together. And even those who were opposing bigger role of Russian language will always remember that Russian-speaking guy that was standing very next to him. And when there will be a discussion about the role of Russian and Ukrainian language in Ukrainian society, they will definitely find this common language.
On the upper floor of a nondescript building in Kyiv, there's a large room with display cases all around. There are large wall maps, posters, and charts. Moving clockwise through the room, you see that it's divided by decade. First the 1920s, then the 30s, and so on until we get to 1990. A discreet sign outside tells the visitor that this is the Museum of the Soviet Occupation.
Ну, ми починаємо, наша виставка починається з цієї карти Совєтського Союзу, на якій показані лагерні управління, систему лагерних управлінь, яка була в СССР.
Roman Krutzik stands in front of a large map. The exhibition starts with a map of the Soviet Union, he says, on which the so-called camp management departments are marked, showing the different concentration camps. There were 230 management departments for concentration camps. Each department had between 9 and 20 camps under its control. Some of the camps had up to 260,000 people in them, the size of a small city.
When you look at this map, the mark, the line that is the border of the old Soviet Union is made to look like barbed wire.
Це була тюрма народів. Це була велика зона. Концтабір.
Yes, he says. It was all one big camp, a jail of nations.
Якщо взяти за такими поміркованими американського історика Роберта Конквеста,
according to the moderate estimates of the American historian Robert Conquest, by 1940, one in 10 people in the USSR was in a concentration camp.
Ну, цей період був дуже важким, тому що з 17 по 24 рік.
In the first years of the Bolshevik government, he says, they just ravaged the treasury and the churches. That's where their income came from. After that, there was a need for economic growth, and they turned to Ukraine as a large agricultural source. They were looking at Ukrainian bread as the gold on which the future USSR would be built.
At the time, I want to go to the Holodomor. At the time of the early 1930s, what was the situation of particularly Ukrainian nationalism? What were the tensions that were within the country around nationalism?
На 30-ті роки в Україні 17-го по 30-ті роки було біля 2000.
The main force opposed to the Bolsheviks was the Ukrainian peasantry, says Roman. During the 1920s, there were many uprisings. For example, among the kulaks, people who had given 20, 30 years of their lives to build something so that they could buy some machinery, a tractor, and then the communist activists came along and took everything. In the 1920s and 30s, there were up to 2,000 insurgent units in Ukraine. Some of these were quite interesting. If all the male population in certain towns had been executed for being insurgents, women's insurgent units were organized. The women armed themselves, killed the Bolshevik commissars, and set up independent government in their own towns.
Які брали в руки зброю, виганяли комуністів і робили своє самоврядування в селі. Ну зараз ми робимо по селянських повстаннях.
What we're doing here is we are rewriting our history. More than 15,000 students come here every year, and many scholars too. Our main focus now is on peasant uprisings in the 1920s. In earlier times, this was forbidden. It was accepted that these were criminal movements. But now we know these people were insurgents.
Завдяки нашій роботі в минулому році, нарешті, за 16 років незалежності,
because of our work, for the first time, people are beginning to use the term the Soviet occupation of Ukraine. Before, you never heard this. It's hard for us. We have to create our own archives, and the sources are few. Those who occupied our lands, not just Russians, but Poles and Romanians, they had their own history to tell. And now, as we're trying to write our version of history, we're facing many problems.
Для мене що означає? Це справа мого життя. Я не отримую за це ніякої ні нагороди, ні заробітної плати. Наоборот, я ще свої гроші.
This museum is the main thing in my life, says Roman. I consider this struggle against the lie to be the main thing in my life. This is how to help the truth to win over the lie.
Побороти неправду.
I was born in 1945 when our village was surrounded with Soviet military units. They took my mother, who was pregnant with me at the time, and they beat her with steel rods until she started to give birth. This is how I was born. After this, when I see that Russia feels in some way superior to us, and I see their attitude to Ukraine, then I understand that the Russians only understand strength. This is how we should act. This museum is, of course, just a museum, but it's all I can do for the truth.
Росіяни – це є ті люди, які тільки кулак знають. Добром ти його не візьмеш, росіянина.
talk a little bit about what you see as the most important differences between those two cultures, between the Russian culture and Ukrainian culture. How are they different?
Well, I think that the main difference is that Ukrainian culture, you know, they sort of come from the same source. They have the same origin. So they date back to the culture of the Kiev Rus, you know, the medieval state that existed in with the center in Ukraine, but also with its fringes in Russia and Belarus in the Middle Ages. Whereas Russians were more under the influence of the Mongol Empire in the early centuries after the collapse of the Kievan Rus, Ukrainians were under the Polish and Lithuanian influence, and they sort of, you know, were more exposed to the Western practices, the European practices, so things like Roman law, and the basic principles, you know, basic ideas of rights and liberties came to Ukraine much earlier than to Russia. I would say maybe in the 15th, 16th century already, you can see them. And then when Russia took over Ukraine in the 17th century, in the end of the 17th century, more or less, it came under huge cultural influence from Ukraine. And actually, the foundations of the Russian culture, I would say until Pushkin, was under just tremendous influence from Ukraine, from Kyiv, and, you know, from especially from the Kyiv Academy, that was the only university that Eastern Slavic people had. So Russia hijacked that culture. So now it calls its this culture part of its cultural heritage. And that's why Ukrainians, I would say more or less in the 19th century, since the early 19th century, embarked on another project, on building a new culture from the scratch. And that culture was based on the Cossack myth. And it also incorporated all those elements, all those ideas of rights and freedoms that came to Ukraine already in the 16th century. In general, that made Ukrainian culture much more democratic, less focused on aristocracy, you know, and on the elites, and much more people's culture, popular culture, if you want, even in its, let's say, elite manifestation.
Many of Ukrainian people are still Soviet, deeply in their mind. Soviet state was from another from one side, really a stable one, which provided people a certain perspective, which had certain social guarantees. From another side, this was a very schizophrenic state, which was trying to destroy people's memory, to erase the facts from it. And this schizophrenic identity is still here, and it's some kind of included into the modern Russian imperialistic way of thinking. So, to my mind, Soviet time destroyed the social structure of Ukraine, and it erased a lot of people who were able of private initiative, who were able of state-like thinking, who were able of responsibility over themselves and responsibility over the destiny of their country. Actually, Soviet time killed patriotism to some extent, because patriotism was a clear propaganda and not a feeling of a state, and we are still dealing with that fact, seeing a massive passiveness in politics and massive cynical approach towards politics, which actually is inherited from the times when the first secretaries of the communist state had a very luxury way of living, and they were speaking about the workers and peasants state, which was a lie.
The great historical project in Ukraine today is to create its own version of the national story. It's part of the groundwork in figuring out the meaning of the nation. What does it mean to be Ukrainian? How do the strands of the past, the golden era of Kievan Rus in the 10th century, the waves of invasion, the Turks, the Mongols, the Cossacks, the Poles, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, all this pulling and pushing, How do they come together and pass through the dreadful years of the Holodomor? How do those years shape the country today? What can be learned from the past? At the National Academy of Sciences, Yuri Shapoval has helped compile a one-volume political history of Ukraine in the 20th century.
Я думаю, що от коли ми здійснювали цей проект за останні 4 роки, ми працювали, то тут уже йдеться не лише про політиків і про політикум, а ми говорили про народ.
While we were working on this book, says Yuri Shapoval, we were concentrating on the nation itself rather than the political elite. The key question was, does the Ukrainian nation have roots as a civil society? And if so, what might those roots be? The nation is patient and calm, used to living with the political status quo, but sometimes we don't reflect enough on what our political leaders are doing. I was with a Canadian colleague and we were talking about all this and discussing how food products here are very expensive, sometimes even more expensive than in Paris. But everyone just accepts this. People don't make demands of the government, don't question such things.
Ну, я думаю, що так воно і є, значить. Тут для України є складна проблема.
The problem is that you can think of Ukrainian history as being the consequence of a series of changes of orientation. People got used to the idea that some other regime could just come along and change everything. Ukrainians have had to adjust to various regimes. You see this particularly in Western Ukraine. I came to the conclusion that the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been the best for them. No nation is a saint, and all nations have their sins. But when you read Ukrainian history and track the changes of orientation, you start to realize that something went wrong with Ukrainian history and the Ukrainian nation as a result of this.
Це процес консолідації, це процес знаходження консенсусу в нашому суспільстві.
I believe the central goal of the Holodomor was the complete destruction of the potential for resistance in Ukrainian society. All the measures applied to Ukrainian society in 1932, beginning with the high crop quotas, they were all aimed at destroying the Ukrainian potential for resistance. To sum it up, I'd go so far as to say that the Holodomor completely changed the Ukrainian nation. Stalin changed forever the Ukrainian sense of identity that had existed before.
Той україноцентричний потенціал, який тут був присутній до подій 32-33 років. І другий, я думаю, все-таки...
But maybe more important, says Yuri, the Holodomor changed the Ukrainian people. I remember myself being a schoolboy and talking to one of my grandmothers. She was telling me the story of her life in the Holodomor, how horrible it had been. When I asked her why it happened, she was too frightened to discuss it. I think that since the time of the Holodomor, fear has settled into the minds of people, and this is far more significant than any failure of leadership. The impact of fear on Ukrainian society as a whole has been far more important than anything else. In the Bielet Церква Civic Museum, they have a room to show what happened in the Holodomor. Groups of schoolchildren come through to see the posters and memorabilia, look at the photographs of long-dead people, stiff in their old-fashioned clothes, some of them forever the villains of the story. The Holodomor is on the school curriculum in Ukraine.
Найбільше страждало сільське населення. І були спроби, щоб якось врятувати себе, своїх діток, були спроби пробратися до міста.
Anyone who lived in the towns and cities had it somewhat better, says the museum guide in Bielet Церква. But those in the villages were doomed to die.
В моїй родині також на вікно ставиться свічка і запалюється. Навіть мій маленький внучок, якому всього 10 років, він це знає.
Every year in my family, we light a candle and put it in the window to remember the Holodomor. Even my 10-year-old grandson, he understands and takes part.
Та воно дуже болить.
It's very painful.
І не так важливо, признають це геноцидом, не признають. Важливо те, щоб...
It doesn't matter whether or not it was a genocide, but the world should know that there was death by hunger here. A Holodomor. It was planned and it was purposeful.
Це просто жахливо.
At the height of it all, 25,000 people a day were dying of starvation. The Holodomor ended in 1933, but no story ever truly ends.
I think for me, the main outcome of this is, you know, the idea that, or the impression that this country is, and this nation is here to stay. So until Maidan, I perhaps had some, you know, doubts about it. You know, the in Ukraine, you feel that culture is sort of endangered, you know. Russian culture is huge. Languages could be seen as endangered, you know, and politically the country was sort of lost between East and West. And the social economic life was depressing with, you know, this terrible corruption and everything. So before Maidan, you could really doubt, you know, that this was a viable project. And now I think all the doubts are gone, and Ukrainians have sort of re-inscribed themselves onto the map of Europe as a nation that will stay here forever, and the country will stay forever regardless of anything that may happen, you know, regardless of all invasions and interventions and anything else. You know, it is now here, it is absolutely open to the world, and it is seen and heard by the world, and it is also part of Europe. And in that sense, for me, it was, of course, also a sort of national and social at the same time revolution, similar to what happened in France in 1789, in Germany in 1848, in many other countries in different times. So now a bit belated, but still it's Ukraine's national revolution, Ukraine's national moment, Ukraine's spring.
A few days ago, I was in Berlin, in this calm, nice city, where transportation goes in schedule and where pumpkins are great and the tea is perfect, and this free city is almost blossoming. Spring has come down and there's no even a single trace of war. People are relaxed and everybody smiles to each other. So here it's different, but I hope this state of mind will come to Ukraine as well.
Alexandra Petrovna Mazur, from the village of Petrushin, remembers the Holodomor.
How did you know the Holodomor was over? What happened in the village?
Ну, було, уже ж садили ж люди шалупайками картошку, і вже давай же сіяли ж маяк, що я знаю, що колацькі вже нарвали миколацьку.
I well remember our being hungry, but I don't have any memory of being full, and I don't remember a certain day when the Holodomor was over. I just remember we began to cook cereal with green wheat stalks and grain. We joined the kolkhoz and we had some flour. I also remember that grain we cooked was the tastiest thing I had ever tasted, and I'm sure I'll never taste anything that good again.
On Ideas, you've been listening to part one of a series called The Great Hunger, produced and presented by Philip Coulter. Special thanks to Roman Serban, Ostap Krivdik, Roman Horbik, and Taras Burnos for their help in making this program. If you want to find out more about the show and what's coming up, or respond to anything you heard in the show, check us out on our website, cbc.ca/ideas. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy. The news is next.